The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, Carrie Klein here, and with me I've got online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the past week's stories from our online daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, we've got an underwater puzzle.
This first story is about some potentially hidden continents, or at least very large landmasses that may exist on Earth. We're not exactly talking Atlantis here, but maybe something not as far-fetched. This has to do with the Indian Ocean, and it turns out that some of the islands in the ocean may actually lie on top of the remains of an ancient continent that was pulled apart by plate tectonics between 50 million and 100 million years ago.
So what tipped scientists off that something like this may even be possible?
Well, Carrie, it turns out that there's a lot of places in the Indian Ocean where Earth's gravity is kind of unusual. Places like Madagascar, the Seychelles, they have slightly stronger gravitational field than is expected. And one thing that might explain it is abnormally thick crust. Hmm. If that's the case, it could be the crust is actually about 25 kilometers thick, which would cause it to resemble continental crust, which is compared to about the 5 to 10 kilometers of oceanic crust elsewhere. So that would be really unusual. However, thickness alone doesn't prove that crust is continental and that you would actually have maybe a hidden continent.
Right.
In this part of the world. So the researchers in this study looked for some other lines of evidence. They reconstructed the movements of the tectonic plates to determine where and how these potential fragments of undersea crust were once connected to the continents. They were able to show that until about 90 million years ago, these places with this really sort of unexpectedly high gravity would have all been attached to India, which is really interesting. And the researchers actually looked for some chemical evidence, and they took sand samples from several beaches in Mauritius, which is an African island located about 1,700 kilometers southeast of the Seychelles. The surface rock of Mauritius is made from volcanic oceanic crust or basalt, but its beach sands contain not just fragments of this eroded lava, but also zircons, which is a mineral associated with continental crust.
But aren't there multiple ways for these zircons to have gotten to these beaches?
That's right. But it turns out that the zircons that they found from Mauritius were hundreds or even thousands of millions of years old. And the island's oceanic crust was less than 10 million years old, which means that these are really coming from a very sort of different place.
And so where would they, how could they have ended up on these beaches then?
Well, Carrie, the idea is that the zircons would have existed in the pre-existing continental crust, but when then the magma that formed Mauritius broke through this crust, it may have carried some of these zircons with them, and they would have become incorporated into the basalt lava that the researchers analyzed.
How cool. I wonder if there could be any more evidence for this out there.
Well, it actually turns out that the Indian Ocean actually could be littered with continental fragments, like the fragments that the researchers are postulating about here. So there actually might be a lot more evidence popping up of this hidden land beneath the waves.
Great. And next up, we've got some news for those of us who are plagued with acne.
Right. Not one of my favorite topics, at least when I was growing up. But it turns out 80% of Americans and a large percentage of other people around the world have acne, especially when they're going through puberty, when they're growing up. And it's recently been speculated that acne is caused by a bacterium or bacteria in the skin. There's one particular bacterium called Propionibacterium acnes, appropriately enough, which seems to be associated with acne, although researchers aren't exactly sure how it causes acne.
Mm-hmm. So here they've made a little bit more of a connection. Tell me about this new study.
Well, what they did was these researchers took 101 people, 49 of whom had acne and 52 which had very normal sort of clean skin, and they swabbed their faces and they examined all the bacterial DNA that they could find. And not surprisingly, they were finding a lot of this Propionibacterium acnes. But what was interesting is it wasn't just this one type of this particular type of bacteria. There's actually a lot of different subtypes of it. In fact, the researchers identified 66 different strains that they hadn't seen before. And they found that two of these strains, which they call RT4 and RT5, tended to be found predominantly in people with acne. But there was one strain called RT6, which was found almost exclusively in people with clear skin.
Interesting. So they found some bacteria tied very clearly to people with acne and some tied to people without.
Exactly.
So, of course, this brings up the question of cause versus association.
Right. And they think there's a causal effect here because they say this good strain, what they're calling this good strain of bacterium, contains genes known to fight off bacterial viruses and other potentially harmful microbes. So they suspect that it actually may be like, you know, the bacteria in our guts are not doing bad things, are actually doing good things. They help us digest food. They may actually even be protecting us from diseases. Maybe very similar with bacteria on our face. Some of them may fight off other harmful microbes, which would otherwise cause acne.
So if true cause and effect were actually to be found here, could this ever lead to an actual therapeutic use for this knowledge?
Right, exactly. And the researchers are sort of making the analogy with probiotics. I don't know if we want to smear bacteria on our face, but you know, maybe we could find what it is about these bacteria that are having this protective effect, isolate the compound, and that could be turned into a drug or potentially a face cream or something like that. So acne may not be with us for good. Who knows?
Right. I'll keep my fingers crossed for the next generation of teenagers.
Right.
And in our final story today, instead of giving it an intro, I just kind of like to read the first sentence here. In the swamp of the blind, the frog with one eye surgically attached to its back is king. What does that mean, Dave?
Well, what it means is we're sort of dealing with Franken frogs here. And actually, not really Franken frogs, but Franken tadpoles. Researchers have taken eyeballs from tadpoles and surgically reattach them to different places on the animal's body, most notably places along their backs.
And why did they do that?
That is a great question. The reason why they did that is they're really trying to get at the roots of vision. What is it about the eyes that help us see? How do they connect? And actually, really beyond that, how do they transmit their visual information to the brain?
Hmm.
And what the researchers were hoping to do is figure out, you know, if we attach eyes to random places on these tadpoles' bodies, will it give us a sense of how this visual information is transmitted to the brain and how it affects behavior?
Right. Okay. So how did eyes transplanted around the body help tell us that information?
Well, what the researchers did was they put these tadpoles sort of in a petri dish. And if they moved to a red portion of the petri dish, they received a mild electric shock. And this was to sort of train them to avoid going to that area. And obviously, those who could see the red were going to avoid this area. And so once the researchers had these tadpoles trained, they made some of them blind. They let some of them keep their eyes, and others, they reattached the eyes to various places around the back. And as expected, those with intact eyes were pretty good at avoiding the red side of the petri dish. And about 40% of them did so. And none of the blind tadpoles were able to avoid the red side of the petri dish. Pretty obvious they couldn't see, but 10% of those with the transplanted eyes, with the eyes transplanted on the back, also avoided the red side of the petri dish, suggesting that some of them were somehow able to see this red side of the petri dish despite not having eyes where they should be, but having the eyes on their backs.
Physiologically, what do scientists think was actually going on in these 10% of blind tadpoles with reattached eyes?
Well, when they looked a little bit closer, they found that only those tadpoles whose transplanted eyes had formed connections with their spinal cords were able to learn to avoid the red side of the petri dish, which suggests that you can't just put an eye anywhere and expect it to work like an eye. It really has to connect to the rest of the nervous system. And indeed, the eyes that were just sort of attached to form connections with the guts or other parts of the body didn't serve any purpose.
Right. So is this knowledge eventually transferable in any way to humans?
Well, that's what the researchers hope. They're learning more about how eyes can be transplanted, how they form connections. And now that we know, you know, sort of some of the connections that are really critical to conferring vision, researchers say that we could have new ways to conduct eye transplants in humans, even ways to create bionic hands and other appendages that could potentially do some of the seeing for us.
Okay, and what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, we've got a story about how birdsong could shed light on the evolution of language in people.
Hmm.
Also a story about some of the earliest nude female figurines that humans created. These are figurines that are tens of thousands of years old, and what they may have been used for, what their purpose was. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a new science scandal happening in Russia. Also a story about this sequester happening in the United States. What are the impacts of the proposed massive budget cuts going to have to scientific researchers, to scientists and their careers? And along those lines, we've actually set up a page on the site where scientists, grad students can come and just sort of share their thoughts about the sequester. How is even the threat of sequester impacting their research, their ideas about future careers? So be sure to check that out on the site. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the science of your dog's brain. What are we learning about canine cognition? And I actually will be moderating that one myself. Next week's Science Live is about open access. What is the latest in the open access publishing debate? You can log on and ask questions from a couple of world experts. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.